Houston, we have a podcast. Welcome to the official podcast of the NASA Johnson Space Center, episode 384, Natural Disaster Response. I'm Dane Turner, and I'll be your host today. On this podcast, we bring in the experts, scientists, engineers, and astronauts, all to let you know what's going on in the world of human spaceflight and more. The view from low Earth orbit can be an advantageous one. For the International Space Station, orbiting 250 miles above the surface of the Earth, it means that it can serve as our eye in the sky, observing our planet below. Equipped with cameras and sensors, it regularly collects imagery and data on geology, temperature, weather, and other natural factors. Here on the planet, we've recently been faced with some major weather events. Last fall, Hurricanes Helene and Milton packed a 1-2 punch on the Gulf Coast of Florida, with Helene continuing all the way into North Carolina. And early this year, the west coast of the U.S. has been dealing with a series of devastating wildfires. The International Space Station's trajectory passes above approximately 90% of Earth's populated area and is able to observe many of these phenomena. With access to so much aerial data, how is NASA able to help in the face of these kinds of events? To tell us about how NASA responds to natural disasters, we have senior Earth system scientist Will Stefanov, who is one of the Center Response Coordinators for the NASA Disasters Program Disaster Response Coordination System, or DRCS. Let's get started. Will, thank you so much for coming on Houston. We have a podcast today.
It's my pleasure. Good, glad to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where are you from? Where did you go to school? What did you study?
Well, I'm originally from Massachusetts, so I'm a Yankee living in Texas. I originally studied at the UMass Lowell campus, and I'm a geologist, and pretty much all of my degrees have been in environmental science and or geology. I did a master's and a PhD at Arizona State University. So that's a sort of a paradise for a geologist, because you can just see all the rocks out there with, you know, no vegetation or anything on top of them, or very little. And so then after that, moved here to Houston to take a job at JSC, working with the Crew Earth Observations Experiment. And I came in as a contractor. I was a contractor for 10 years and then became a civil servant. And that coincided with a change in the ISS, the International Space Station, being used as a remote sensing platform for a number of different instruments. The Crew Earth Observations payload or experiment is handheld camera crew imagery taken out of the ISS windows. And that, for a very long time, that was the only real remote sensing instrument or activity on the ISS. Then, right around 2014 or so, we started getting more sensors, Science Mission Directorate-funded sensors, on board the space station. And at that time, the program decided, well, we want to have someone who is a remote sensing expert, which is kind of one of the focuses of my particular research, my particular expertise, to help guide the Crew Earth Observations team and also expand what they did into a broader portfolio of remote sensing from the International Space Station. So that's, I took leadership of that group and did that up until about 2019 or so. And then I decided to take a detour into management for a while and became the branch chief for our Exploration Science Office. And that is a role that I just recently stepped away from to become the senior Earth System Scientist within the Exploration Science Office. And in that role now, I still continue to support the ISS program. I serve them as their program scientists for Earth observations, and that role hasn't changed. But now I also work with our NASA Disasters Program as one of the Johnson Space Center response coordinators, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit later. That's pretty much where I am these days.
Fantastic. So you said the ISS, as a science platform, it does a lot of Earth observations. And you said that, you know, we started with just crew observations looking down, but now we've got other sensors up there. Can you tell us, like, what some of those sensors are and the things they track?
Sure. So right now we have a number of sensors, external sensors, they're mounted on the outside of the space station, that are looking at various Earth system processes. We have the eco-stress sensor, that is a thermal infrared sensor that is looking at evapotranspiration in plants. Essentially, it's looking at heat stress from plants and seeing how they react. There's also the JEDI sensor, which is a LIDAR instrument. So it's collecting three-dimensional information on surface biomass. Essentially, it's mapping the canopy, vegetation canopy, across the surface of the Earth. We also have the SAGE-3 instrument. This is an aerosol sounding instrument that looks at things like ozone in the atmosphere. And then we also have the Orbiting Carbon Observatory, which is looking at carbon dynamics. So looking at CO2 in the atmosphere, looking how that's exchanged between the ground and the atmosphere, and just seeing how those dynamics work in terms of the whole broader Earth system.
Wow, you guys are tracking a whole bunch of stuff from orbit up there.
We are. And one of the most recent ones is the EMIT instrument. Their science objective is to characterize dust surfaces, dust generation areas on the surface of the Earth, and characterize what the mineralogy of that dust is. That information feeds directly into determining what kind of aerosols we have in the atmosphere, in particular whether we have more dark aerosols in the atmosphere or light aerosols in the atmosphere. And that helps us understand how heat energy balance works across the planet.
What kind of things are aerosols?
Aerosols are things like when you have a large fire, you'll see the visible soot. There's also much smaller particles that are produced as part of combustion. Also things like very, very small minerals. When you see a dust storm, all that dust, those are all aerosols. You also have aerosols that come off of the ocean surface, salt particles that come off. So all of these are aerosols, and they all have impacts on how energy is balanced across the planet.
Fascinating. So we've got all these instruments up there on the space station, and on Earth we have weather phenomena, and you're tracking lots of different types of these things. I know we watch the hurricanes, we get a lot of footage of those, and I know that we recently saw some imagery of the wildfires from space. Can you tell us a little bit more about like what type of weather phenomena you're looking at from the space station using these instruments?
It's pretty much, as you just brought up, for what we do, I mean, we do a lot of general monitoring. Many of these sensors are collecting data on a regular basis over specific areas of the Earth to help their science. In the event of a large disaster event, say like a hurricane or a wildfire, then we engage in two ways from the ISS. For many years, since 2012, we've been tracking international disaster charter events. This is an international group, an agreement between the space agencies of the Earth, like NASA or JAXA. And the idea there is if something happens and a country requests aid, they request information, then those agencies can provide that data as it's available. And so the ISS became part of this program in 2012, and primarily it's been the handheld crew imagery is what we collect for that. So it's when we have a big hurricane or a wildfire or earthquakes, then we get a request, and then we activate the CEO team, the Crew Earth Observations team, to see whether the crew can image it. More recently, we've become part of the NASA Disasters Program, and in particular, it's we're calling it the Disaster Response Coordination System. This is an interconnected system between various centers who have expertise in remote sensing. They can look at data that NASA collects and some of our other partners like ESA, and we can develop products from that data that is responsive to requests from people dealing with disasters on the ground. And those people are governmental agencies. They don't necessarily have to be federal governmental agencies. They can be state or even local, or non-governmental organizations like the Red Cross. We can respond to requests to those. If we get a request, something has happened, and someone reaches out to us, like, say, FEMA, for example, first we assess the request to see if it's something that we can respond to. Like if someone's asking for a very specific kind of data, you know, do we have the expertise to enable us to produce that data or that data product? If we decide we do, then we set up a response team that is composed of various members from different centers. And then we reach out to our subject matter expert networks that exist at the different centers and ask them, can we produce a burn map, fire severity map, a map of disturbed buildings, for instance, or a flooding map? And we engage our SMEs to do that. Once we have that data, we then make it available on our data portal for the requester to download, but it's also available to pretty much anyone who's involved in the disaster response. We also coordinate very tightly with the groups responding on the ground. And typically that tends to be FEMA is one of our major response partners. And if it's for some very large events, like major hurricanes, we can actually staff someone in their coordination center that they set up to deal with that. So that there's direct communication. The whole purpose behind the DRCS is to increase coordination and increase communication and increase what NASA can do to help out for people responding to these events. And so we've developed this very tight system to track our involvement, make sure everyone's talking to everyone else. And that's one of my primary roles in that system, in my current position, is that I'm the disaster response coordinator for Region 6, which is, we use the same thing as FEMA regions. So that includes New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana. And so my job is to create those networks among the various emergency management response entities within that region. So, for instance, I'm spending a lot of time talking with FEMA Region 6 representatives on their geographic information systems teams or their emergency response teams, letting them know what NASA can do for them, essentially, and setting up those coordination networks. So once we get our requests, we develop our data, we provide it to whoever requested it, we then continue that as long as we need to. And we assess whether we continue to need to, whether we've satisfied the request, whether we need to have some follow-up with our partners. Once we're all happy that, okay, NASA's done what we can do, they don't really need anything else from us, we then decide to deactivate our network. And once we do that, then we have an after-action report. We go over lessons learned. We solicit any feedback from our partners. You know, were the data products that we produced useful? Was our process useful? How can we improve it? And then we record that. The data will be available. The data remains available on our data portal if someone wants to go back for it, say for later research or just wants to revisit something. And then we ready ourselves for the next event.
When these groups are asking for data from you, what kind of data are they looking for? Is this mostly imagery, or is there other things that that your group tracks with the Earth observations that would be useful to them?
It's primarily imagery, that's a broad word that I'm using because we use a lot of our data sets are optical or visible imagery, not just visible wavelengths, but other wavelengths that can be useful for looking at things like material identifications or for looking at things like disturbance, changes in a land surface from one image prior to an event to images after an event or during an event. We also use other types of sensor data like radar data. We can get that. That's very useful for tracking things like disturbance, surface disturbance, also flooding. It can be useful for. So it's primarily orbital data sets, although we can also use airborne data sets as well. We haven't done too much with ground-based networks, if we have access to them, we do incorporate some of that data, like from partners like the U.S. Geological Survey, stream gauge data, you know, to help in assessing flooding or areas that might be impacted by flooding. That's the primary data sets that we use. As far as the products, I can use some examples, like for Hurricanes Helene and Milton, we were looking at things like flooding extent, and assessing what areas would be susceptible to flooding. And for that, you can use a variety of different data sets, both optical and radar. We also, for the recent Southern California fires, we had many requests for disturbance maps, burn severity maps, where's the fire located? Also, where are smoke plumes going? Because there are health effects associated with smoke plumes, particularly if you're burning built-up areas. You know, buildings have a lot of materials in them that when they combust, they don't produce things that are very useful, very good to breathe. So we're interested in that. We had requests for methane mapping, and that's something that the EMIT sensor on the ISS has the capability to do. And so we were working with that team to see if they could develop methane maps for some of the areas around Southern California. So it's really dependent on what the event is and what the requester needs. We create bespoke products like that when we can or when requested to. We also maintain a series of near real-time sort of standard data products on our mapping portal. These are things that in remote sensing, there's usually a trade-off between high frequency of data collection and resolution. If you want really high frequency data, typically that tends to be lower resolution. If you want very highly detailed, high spatial resolution data, that typically is something you can only collect on very specific times, like from an airborne instrument or something like that. There's always the trade-off there. That's part of the whole coordination network and why we engage our subject matter experts. So we can really, we don't want to tell requesters, you know, sure, we can produce whatever you need. We need to make sure that we can, in fact, produce what they need and in a timely fashion for it to be useful in an event.
So we've mentioned hurricanes, floods, wildfires. Are there other things that, other disasters that your team has been asked to respond to, like maybe droughts, or I know we have tracked the Saharan dust clouds. Are those things that you might be responding to?
We don't typically respond to those within the disaster response framework that NASA has. Those are things that are certainly tracked from a more scientific investigation standpoint. Let's say for Saharan dust, where dust is coming from is one of the things that the EMIT team is looking at. Droughts is something that we can look at in data over a long period of time. And drought conditions can have some effect on events that happen like high precipitation. I mean, if the soil is dried out, depending on what its composition is, suddenly having a huge influx of precipitation can lead to things like enhanced surface runoff, gullying, landslides is something else that we are frequently asked to create maps for, particularly following large precipitation events. For things like Hurricane Helene and Milton, that was a concern. We had all this precipitation, and you can get subsequent landslides. After large fire events that remove vegetation from hillsides, then if that's followed by heavy precipitation, like you had in California, that can also lead to landslides. So there's the event itself. You can also have follow-on events or sometimes even compound events where you have multiple things happening at the same time. And so we try to balance all those requests and see what kind of data we can produce to help out.
So we've been talking about the sensors on the outside of the station, and you mentioned that we started out with just crew observations. Do the crews currently help with this data collection by taking photo and video themselves?
They do. They do, absolutely. In fact, I'd say the crew handheld imagery is still sort of the major workhorse data set that we collect for disaster response from the ISS. We have a whole internal system set up here at JSC to prioritize data collection for events like this. All of the data that the crew collects using the handheld camera images or using the handheld cameras is what we call task listed. In other words, it's crew discretion. If something is a very major event, then we may be able to timeline them. So it shows up on their crew schedule for the day. It's sort of like, okay, this is we expect you to do this, rather than do it if you have time and interest. So whenever we hear of an event that's happened, whether it's through the International Disaster Charter or the DRCS or some other avenue, then what we do, the CEO team here will then construct what we call a small data nugget. And this is just information for the crew and other sensor teams, that because we do send it out to the other sensors that are capable of collecting data useful for an event, depending where it is. We then, this little data package tells them what the event is, what kind of data we're looking at. In the case of the handheld camera imagery, what's the best lens to use because we're looking for a certain spatial resolution of data. We then send that up, and then we add it to the daily target message evaluation process that the crew, that CEO does. They pretty much look at the ISS orbit, see where it's going to be, look at cloud cover conditions, basically to determine, is the crew actually going to be able to see anything? And if they can, then it's sent up as a crew target, and it's called out as a disaster response target, which puts it on the crew schedule as, okay, if you're going to take this imagery, this is the highest priority thing. As soon as they collect it, they then take it off the camera, put it on the station network so that it can be automatically downlinked to the ground. Once it's downlinked through Marshall Space Flight Center, it then gets the JSC, goes through our Building 8 team, they assign numbers to it, then it comes to the CEO team, where then we geo-reference it. So handheld camera imagery, unlike a lot of other remotely sensed data, does not have inherent geolocation information. And by that, I mean each pixel in the image has a geographic coordinate attached to it. That's really how things like Google Earth work. And if you bring out like ArcGIS, you have a base map and you bring in an image, say from Landsat or one of the Sentinel satellites from ESA, you can pretty much import that and it will fall on the surface, the Earth's surface, where it's supposed to. You know, the imagery will drape over mountains, streets will line up, buildings will be in more or less the correct place. That's all because of that embedded geographic information. Handheld camera imagery from the ISS doesn't have that. So over the past few years, we've been using machine learning techniques here at JSC to add that capability after the imagery comes down to essentially do that full georeferencing, so that when you import an astronaut photograph that's been georeferenced into a GIS system or Google Earth, it will lay on the Earth's surface as you would expect it to. And that capability has made that data set much more useful now for disaster response. Now we can actually take the handheld imagery and feed it into a GIS system where it can be useful by people on the ground. And that has happened in several instances that we've responded to. We also collect a lot of nighttime imagery, city lights data. And from the ISS data collected by the crew is still the highest resolution publicly available nighttime data set available. And so we're refining our capability to fully georeference that information as well, because that kind of data is particularly useful, say, following a hurricane or a wildfire. It's very useful for mapping where is power out, you know, because, hey, no more lights, you know. So you can both, it's helpful for both determining where areas have been impacted, so ground response organizations can then go out and direct their efforts, prioritize their efforts. But it's also useful for recovery, because you can use that data to track where power is being restored and how much still needs to be restored. And so that's a capability that we're seeing asked for and used on a more frequent basis, both with data from the ISS and data from some of the other orbital sensors out there.
That's an incredible amount of data that you're able to grasp just from the astronauts themselves and their photographs, and a lot of processing back on the ground to match things up. You mentioned earlier volcanoes. Have there been some significant eruptions that you've helped with for disaster response?
For disaster response, not since I have been part of the DRCS currently. Although I can give you a story that sort of relates.
Yeah, great.
So several years ago, this is an example of why crew are a good thing to have, and windows on your spacecraft are a good thing to have. The ISS was orbiting over Cleveland Volcano.
Where's that?
That's in the Aleutian Island chain. And it's an active volcano. The U.S. Geological Survey is aware it's an active volcano, but it wasn't one that had erupted in recent memory. So it wasn't very instrumented. For a lot of active volcanoes, the USGS has various sensors on the ground that can map things like the ground surface changing, which is an indicator that magma may be coming up and inflating the ground surface as a precursor to an eruption. So Jeff Williams, an astronaut who was on the ISS at the time, just happened to be looking out the window and he saw an eruption beginning to occur. So he took a camera, took some images of it. And then he decided, he said, well, I don't know if anybody knows about this. So he called down from the ISS to the U.S. Geological Survey and said, hey, you have an erupting volcano. Are you aware of it? And as he tells the story, he first had to convince them that he was actually calling them from the space station. And then once they became convinced, they then looked at other data collected from other sensors, other robotic sensors, and they're like, hey, wow, you're right. It is erupting. And Cleveland has continued to be active since that time. And so now it is an instrumented island, an instrumented volcano by the USGS, and they're watching it more closely. So that's one example of how a volcanic eruption really illustrates why the ISS is a good component of this whole system, and why having astronauts on board is a good thing.
That's incredible. And are many volcanoes monitored like that from space?
There almost is. Yes, the short answer is yes. we examine quite a few of them with the CEO project, and there are other groups using other satellite assets who are regularly look at volcanoes that are active. Even, you know, they don't necessarily have to be erupting. In fact, a lot of our imagery that we asked crew to collect is not necessarily because a volcano is erupting, but because it is active. It's important to get before and after imagery so you can tell what's changed and you can map new deposits.
You've also mentioned earthquakes. Can you tell me a little bit more about the responses to those?
Yes. So earthquakes, if one occurs, we would work with the USGS very closely. They have a very extensive earthquake monitoring network and group. We could develop some data products from that, most likely disturbance maps using radar data. That can also be useful to map where the earthquake has ruptured the Earth's surface, if it has done so. We can also use crew imagery for that. And this is a relatively new capability. It's related to the longer lenses that we now have on board the ISS. Previous to, I'd say, 3 or 4 years ago, we couldn't collect data using the handheld camera images that was a sufficiently high resolution that you could actually see something on the ground as a result of an earthquake that you could unambiguously point to and say, yes, that's damage from the earthquake, or that's a new fault scarp or fissure that was caused by the earthquake. But the recent earthquakes that occurred in Turkey and Syria, the crew had access to much longer lenses on the ISS, and they took imagery of areas surrounding the earthquake epicenter. And when we looked at that data, we began to realize that we could actually see landslides on some of the surrounding mountain ranges. And so this was really one of the first indicators that, okay, we now have sufficient resolution on the ISS with the cameras to be able to collect imagery that could be useful for earthquake response. We can map things like landslides. So that's a quantum leap forward in our capabilities here from JSC and the ISS program.
So mentioning landslides, are there areas that you monitor regularly that are maybe at risk of landslides that you just keep an eye on to see if there are changes?
From the ISS, generally no. We don't have any active science requests for that kind of work. But certainly the USGS keeps track of landslides, landslide-prone areas. And if an event occurs, like a wildfire, extensive wildfire or a very high precipitation event, then if we're requested to do so, that is something that we would then engage the DRCS to generate new landslide maps if necessary, collect new data to assess whether landslides that have been known, you know, already identified, have been activated or new ones have activated.
Fantastic. So what kinds of things are you able to learn from all of these different areas that you can learn from space that you can't get from the ground?
Well, the vantage point from space allows you to see a much larger area in a very holistic sort of snapshot in time way. When you're on the ground, you're fairly limited to dealing with what's right around you. When you have the broader view from orbital or airborne data, you can get a more regional sense of what's happening. You can see, all right, well, we're working on this fire front right here, but, oh, there's another fire front which we're seeing over here. So it helps, it works together with the ground observations just to make sure that we have a broader contextual view of an event and what's happening with it. It's also useful for sort of in a post-event type of way. It's useful to help improve the science on disasters and what what their effects are. For instance, say the data that we've collected from the Southern California wildfires, that information, those maps that we developed, they were useful in the moment for emergency response. They can also now be useful for people researching what happens after vegetation is removed following a wildfire, what happens to the soil properties after a big wildfire goes through, how does that affect landslide formation, soil mobilization and runoff. All of those things, all that research then feeds into better preparedness for the next thing. You know, the next time it happens, we have a better sense of these are the kind of things we need to be looking out for. These are the kind of effects we can expect to happen after this event.
So all this data really helps long-term to help with the response, not just the response, but also preparing afterwards, preparing for maybe the next event or just the rebuilding of the event and make sure everything is going along correctly for that.
Absolutely. And and some of this data can also be used. Something that's very big in emergency management training, and for us too on the DRCS is simulations. You know, preparing people for how to respond to an event. You know, what are the steps that need to be taken? And this data that we collect and keep after an event is also directly useful for those kind of simulations. You know, we don't have to make up an event from scratch. We can say this actually happened, and this is what we actually saw. And we can design our training programs accordingly.
What kind of simulations do you do to prepare?
They're called generally the tabletop simulations. So you could have a very common simulation for our part of the country down here is hurricane simulations. You know, we just construct a scenario where there's a Cat 3 hurricane, which is hit. I'll just use Houston because here we are. A Cat 3 hurricane is predicted to impact Houston in a week. You know, what do we do? How do we prepare for it? This is where you engage the various organizations that would be involved in a response and the preparation for it. And so from the NASA perspective, we would be engaged in, all right, what happens when we activate? You know, we in this simulation, we receive a request from FEMA. We want to know, we would like before imagery, imagery during the event and after imagery. And so then we work through the simulation and we model what happens, like what sensors do we have available at the time the hurricane is passing? What's the weather conditions going to be like? You know, if it's completely cloud covered, do we have other assets that we can use, say like radar assets that can image the ground surface through the clouds? And so we work all of those processes to make sure that we're coordinating with each other, we're scheduling data collections from the various sensors, we're engaging the appropriate science teams that would need to be engaged to develop products, and making sure that all of our reporting channels are set up correctly.
And with these tabletop sims, it's you guys sitting around a table and working through this step-by-step, how you would respond? Is that how it works?
In the classical sense, yes. Historically, you would be sitting around a table. You can, of course, now do things a little bit more remotely. You can engage a number of different organizations in the tabletop exercise. They may not necessarily all be around a table, but
okay. So it can be electronic through email or through something.
Yeah,
like
and
that.
And that's part of the simulation too. It's also modeling what are the communication pathways, you know, and making sure that those are set up correctly.
Okay, that's really cool. So what outside groups, I know you mentioned FEMA earlier, what other outside groups are you often working with for the responses?
FEMA is the major one, certainly in my time with the DRCS. We just rolled out this version of it last year in summer up at headquarters. So we're still finalizing our processes, you know, fine-tuning them. Between FEMA, we also work a lot with the U.S. Geological Survey. Their landslide team is a team that we correspond with quite frequently for events where we're concerned about that kind of hazard. We do work with some NGOs like Red Cross, and we also work with regional and local areas. For instance, for the Southern California wildfires, we were working with Los Angeles County. We were working with the City of Los Angeles, and you know, we're all part of it is coordinating with all of these various entities, you know, responding to their requests and making sure everyone's getting what they need.
I know you you give all the data to these organizations, everything, but does NASA have any physical presence at the responses? What does NASA do specifically for these responses?
Our role is primarily data collection and data product delivery. We don't typically get involved in the on the ground response. As I mentioned earlier, for some events we have staffed or had someone representative in the FEMA response coordination centers for an event, but in terms of actually like being on the ground, doing firefighting or debris clearing, we don't typically do that. That's not our purview as NASA. Like I said, we are primarily a data collection and data analysis agency, and that's our role.
You've been at this for a little while. Do you have any memorable moments with any responses that you've been a part of?
I would say, one comes to mind. Several years ago, in a previous incarnation of the disasters program, I was the center coordinator at that time, and this was when we had Hurricane Harvey come through, and we were having daily coordination calls. And it was a bit of a surreal experience to call in. Fortunately, I had power during that event to call in and give the report from JSC and tell them, "Well, I'm actually in the event. You know, it's happening right now. There's water coming through the roof of my house. So my report is going to be short. But here's what we're doing." Yeah, that's probably one of the most memorable things I have, both reporting on it and being involved in the response to it, but also being actively affected by it.
Oh my goodness. So speaking of Houston, we're in a very vulnerable zone for things like hurricanes and floods and even tornadoes as well. What sort of plans are there in place to keep NASA workers safe, both on the ground and in space when there's a weather event at JSC?
That's mostly our emergency management group here does that sort of planning. From our perspective, I can work with them to kind of let them know what data we have available to them from NASA, particularly to help map things like flooding. And we do work with the emergency management group there as well. They also work with us a little bit. As I'm sure you're aware, we house the Apollo moon samples. And so our group here has processes in place when something happens to safe all of that material. And that's part of our emergency management plans. But really that sort of the workforce planning and response, like when the center closes and how people continue to do their work if they're able, that's more on the emergency management sort of center operations end of things.
With all of these different organizations that you've worked with and everything, do they give you feedback on what you're able to provide and how you can improve things?
They do, and we actively solicit that from them. That's how we learn and can help improve our processes. A lot of the products that we produce, since they are these are the bespoke products, they are kind of given with the caveat of this is a prototype product. You know, this is what we were able to produce. Sort of use at your own risk. And the response agencies they understand that in many cases for these responses, any data that they get is useful. And you know, since we're producing it from NASA, we do provide it with a certain level of confidence. You know, we're the subject matter experts that we employ to do these things. These are people who've worked on looking at disturbance and mapping it from remotely sensed instruments for their careers, you know, or they're experts in fire dynamics. And so the products that we produce have a certain baseline level of expertise that go into them. But like any kind of remotely sensed product, until you have really detailed calibration, validation data, ground truth data, you can't put boundaries on exactly how accurate it is. So we just make sure that we make our partners aware of that if they ask us to produce something.
You've talked a bit about data portals, and are these publicly available?
Yes, the disasters our mapping portal is open, and it uses just common formats for GIS systems or Google Earth type systems like GeoTIFF and ArcGIS formats. You can check out what we have at maps.disasters.nasa.gov. And you can explore our portal. We have a number of different products, the near real-time products that I mentioned earlier that you can access through the portal. We have we maintain archives for the events that we've covered. We have a number of dashboards that point you to different classes of disaster, like data we've collected for floods or hurricanes or such. And for some events, after the event is done, we can also produce ArcGIS story maps. So that if someone is interested in getting that kind of sort of narrative format of what the event was and what we did to respond to it, that's available in there too, rather than sifting through folders of data.
That's really cool. Is there a way that maybe the public can get involved in the collection or analysis of this?
Generally speaking, I'd say we don't have any systems like that set up right now. There are programs that certainly do solicit citizen science data, like the GLOBE program. And there have been efforts to use public data like social media reports or even cell phone locations to feed into things like earthquake response, measure. But we don't have direct systems set up like that for the DRCS at present.
Is there anything else about the JSC disaster response that you would like to let people know about?
I'd say it's a good example of how the International Space Station is useful for this. Prior to about 2012, it was all orbital systems, and at the time the program started talking with the International Disaster Charter about how the ISS could be involved in that. We are collecting data too, and it being a crewed platform, it has a sort of a unique advantage over a lot of the robotic sensor systems in that you have humans on board. Literally, they can look out a window and see something happening. They could see a volcanic eruption beginning. They can see a hurricane from angles that you don't typically get from other sensors. And when we made that case and realized that, this is a very valuable data set that we collect, then we started getting traction on, let's involve the ISS in this. And I'd say that has continued since then, where that's why JSC is part of the DRCS primarily, is because of the International Space Station connection. And the fact that we interface directly with that platform and collect that data and can make it available for the DRCS.
This has been absolutely fascinating, and I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I mean, this is an activity that I think it's useful to let people know that NASA does this, and it really highlights a very applied use of all the data that we collect from our various sensor systems, directly to help out the humanitarian needs. And helping to prepare us for the next, the next disaster that's going to happen, because unfortunately, we can probably expect that they will.
Houston, go ahead.
Off of the space shuttle.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
The shuttle has cleared the tower.
Became indeed for all mankind.
It's actually a huge honor to break a record like this.
Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Never Houston, welcome to space.
Thanks for sticking around, and I hope you learned something new today. You can check out the latest from around the agency at nasa.gov, and if you want to check out NASA's disaster response data yourself, you can find it at maps.disasters.nasa.gov. Our full collection of episodes and all the other wonderful podcasts around the agency can be found at nasa.gov/podcasts. On social media, we're on the NASA Johnson Space Center pages of Facebook, X, and Instagram. If you have any questions for us or suggestions for future episodes, email us at nasa-houstonpodcast@mail.nasa.gov. This interview was recorded on February 28th, 2025. Our producer is myself, Dane Turner. Audio engineers are Will Flato and Daniel Tohill. And our social media is managed by Dominique Crespo. Houston We Have a Podcast was created and is supervised by Gary Jordan. Special thanks to Victoria Segovia for helping us plan and set up this interview. And of course, thanks again to Will Stefanov for taking the time to come on the show. Give us a rating and feedback on whatever platform you're listening to us on, and tell us what you think of our podcast. We'll be back next week.
3, 2, 1.
This is an official NASA podcast.